Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I will be quick up the top here. Really excited about today's episode. Mikey Robbins is just one of my favourite people on the planet. There are probably in my career very few people who have been nicer to me along the way, who have been more generous in welcoming me into their world and being supportive of what it is that I do. I am a great admirer of how brilliant his wit is. He's one of the great conversationalists. If you ever have the opportunity to have a lunch with Mikey Robbins, he enjoys a lunch and he is charming and wonderful and beautiful and heartfelt and enthusiastic company at a lunch and also on this podcast, I hope. I hope you're really going to enjoy this one. Mikey changed my life in various ways, or at least was there when my life changed. In various ways at different points in my life. One of them comes up again, as it did in the Helen Razor podcast, the first time I ever listened to Triple J, where I saw The Breakfast Show live at the University of Canberra bar and saw Mikey and Helen perform. And, you know, it's funny, I studied journalism at university, but, you know, I'm not a journalist. But the thing I saw in O Week, which was, you know, this amazing radio show, ended up being a show that I did myself for 5 years, and it was Mikey and Helen who first invited me into Triple J. It was Mikey and Helen who used to get me on their show and allow me opportunities to do little bits with them that, you know, got me into that family and you know, created opportunities for me down the track to, you know, obviously host The Breakfast Show with Adam there on Triple J for five of the, you know, best years of my entire life, you know, one of the great all-time jobs. That job was. And the older you get, the more that you look back and realize, you know, what a wonderful time and what a wonderful organization and place and opportunity, you know, that job was. And so Mikey was instrumental in that, but he was also very instrumental on the show that, you know, kind of gave me an opportunity for my name to get out there in a television sense, which was the TV show called Good News Week on the ABC. And when Good News Week started up, you know, I was a pretty new comedian and it was the first big TV opportunity they got. And it was a show that, in a general sense, you know, suited what it was that I was, you know, good at, or, you know, was good enough at my age to get an opportunity on a show like that. But it was a show like that that gave lots of young people, you know, people who weren't necessarily ready yet, you know, including myself, you know, an opportunity to get the experience to get ready. And I love doing that show. I still don't know if I've ever had more fun doing television than being a guest on Good News Week, and, you know, being often, you know, sitting next to, you know, some of your favorite comedians in the world that you had grown up, you know, idolizing, and then you got to, you know, go out and make up a show on the spot with them, you know, improvise and riff and go back and forward and make each other laugh. It was just such great times, and, you know, being the guest and being the, you know, the turtle, the bottom of the rung guest, but also the person, you know, who's there is least expectation on, you know. It's your job just to, you know, be funny and fun and just be part of it. You gotta get a couple of good lines or jokes or whatever away and you've done your bit. Good fun times. And so, you know, Mikey was always often, most of the time, sitting across from me, which was great as well, because he is so quick-witted that it might have been a bit harder to get as many jokes away on that show if I had been on the same team as Mikey. I don't think I would have ever got him with my bit first, because his brain works so beautifully and quickly. Anyway, so I love Mikey Robbins. He's one of the all-time great blokes, and I really enjoyed having him on the podcast. We recorded this before Christmas, and I was going to try to get it up before Christmas, but unfortunately just life got in the way, as it sometimes does. 2018 has been a lot of people, well, anyway, I don't need to go into it, but it was a terrible, terrible year. It was just one of those years where, yeah, plenty of great stuff happened last year. And, you know, at some stage, I'm sure that I will look back on that great stuff, and, you know, time will give me a perspective that, you know, I can look back and reflect on the, you know, the victories of 2018 and the things that, you know, were great about 2018. But unfortunately, it was one of those years where, like many people, there were a series of other things that overwhelmed the positivity, and it was hard to see, you know, the light through the darkness sometimes. And so as much as I know that, you know, dates are very, very arbitrary. In fact, you know, there's no no reason that people can't be listening to this well after, you know, the point that A, the podcast was recorded, and B, when I recorded this introduction, you know. Anyway, you don't need me to get bogged down in a discussion of time, but I am one of those people this year at the very least who I'm starting 2019 hoping that it will be a much better year than 2018. And so I thought, you know, why not start the podcast with one of my great friends and my great mentors and you know, just a guy that I like to sit down and chat to. So this is Mikey Robbins. Buy his book, you know. You're going to enjoy the book, but also, you know, support Mikey. He's a brilliant mind, and I want him to write more books. Anyway, I think heaps of people are buying his books, but you know, you should buy his books too. All right, this is Mikey Robbins. Enjoy. Oh, I'm back. I realized the whole point of that introduction was that I was meant to plug my shows that I have coming up. So my show is called Will Informed. Hobart is on sale at the moment, and also Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Hobart. If you want to come and see that show, get in quick. It is selling very well. Melbourne International Comedy Festival is also selling well, but there's 20 shows in a 1,000-seat venue. So there's still plenty of tickets available. But yeah, come out and see the new show. Not going to Adelaide or Brisbane for their comedy festivals this year, which is, I think, only the second time I've missed Adelaide in 20 years. And it's been a long time since I haven't done the Brisbane Comedy Festival. So it's going to be a different start to this year than usual, which I'm excited about. You know, I'm sad to be missing those festivals, which I love very much, but I have to go overseas in January, and I've got some work commitment. Anyway, you don't need to know all this stuff. Anyway, the plug, just do the plug. Hobart, Melbourne, on sale now. Other places to come, they'll be on sale then. comedy.com.au. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and I'm very excited about today's episode because the person we are going to talk to is not only a great friend of mine, but also a man who was probably the most kind to me when I first entered the comedy industry, Certainly the most supportive of me, and provided a great deal of opportunities for me. So it's a great pleasure to be able to sit down at a table with a guy who I consider a friend, but also a mentor and a role model. And this is how the podcast starts. I ask the guests who they are. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Mikey Robbins. Apparently, I'm Will's mentor.
Well, I think that is not an unfair thing to say. Do you have an awareness of that? Do you have an awareness that you were kind to me when I was starting out?
Absolutely not, mate. I remember seeing you doing a gig, and I remember thinking, this guy's funny and this guy's generous. And I would say that's pretty much how you've carried yourself through your career. You know, and the funny is a lay down misere, but you've always been a very generous performer.
I think that I had good role models. I think I was inspired to that generosity because we all have within us a sense of meanness, you know, as comedians. And I, by the way, don't mean to deny that I'm as happy as anybody else to sit around and wish one of my good friends misfortune like normal people do. That's just part of being a human.
Every time a friend of mine succeeds, a tiny part of me dies.
Right.
It's like, yeah, you know, I was looking at Twitter, so I said, I adore Josh Thomas, and his show's been picked up. A little part of me's just, I'm happy for him, but a little part of me's dead.
Yeah, well, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with acknowledging that. Like, I've spoken about on the podcast before, Ronnie Cheng, who's been on this podcast, who...
You're a nice guy.
I could not be a bigger fan of, and could not be happier for all the opportunities that he has gotten, and could not be more excited how respectful he is of the pathways that got him there and all those sort of things. Yeah, like, he's good people.
Yeah.
But when he got The Daily Show and I didn't get The Daily Show, a little bit of you still fucking dies.
Yeah, yeah, that's great, mate. As a comedian, you spend your life as the person that didn't win the Oscar. It's like, yay, that's great for you. And, you know, one thing I've learned is, because, you know, I've been doing this since, God... the Menzies years, I think.
Well, when did it start?
1990.
Okay. So, yeah. Time for the Guru and also Mikey Robbins.
Yes. Yes. They'd been the Guru. I remember those stickers. Shit. Yeah, 1990. I was writing sketches at Triple J. I just thought I'd get a job there by osmosis. I thought if I just hang around long enough, they'll give me a gig. And then I lied and said I knew how to operate a radio panel, and I still hold the record for taking the station off air the most amount of times in one shift.
How many times in one shift?
16.
Oh, that is a lot.
That's a lot, mate.
Because it takes a little while to take it offline, and it probably takes a little while to get it back up again. Yeah, so really.
Yeah, 16 times I had to go to the standby tape. And I got called in by the late Stuart Matchett. I did it on the Saturday night, and I got called in to his office on the Monday. And I thought, well, that's it. They're never going to let me near a radio studio again. And he went, oh, so how did it go the other night? I went, oh, he didn't hear. So I went, fine. He went, oh, good. Can you do Thursday and Friday? And I went, yeah, all right.
Can you remember what the song was on the emergency tape that would come in when you went off air?
EMF.
EMF, unbelievable.
I think it was unbelievable, yeah. This is how long ago it was, man. There were turntables in the studio, and you had to line up with a quarter turn a piece of vinyl before you started, because they believed that if everything fell apart, at least the vinyl wouldn't. But I'd never got around to doing that. But I'm being unbelievable by EMF a lot. Or as Michael Tom once called them, EMF.
EMF.
Remember Tunny?
Yeah, of course. I mean, well, so I discovered Triple J, and I spoke to your great colleague Helen Razor about this when she came on this podcast. But I discovered Triple J when I went to university because where I was from in country Victoria, we didn't have a Triple J back then. Triple J became increasingly important for country children as a way to connecting them to the rest of Australia. But that happened sort of from post when I got to university onwards.
Well, actually, that was one of the most exciting things of being at the J's in the 90s. When I first started, it had gone from Sydney into the capital cities, but then going regional was wild. And you know, you get faxes, yes, faxes, boys and girls, from kids in country towns who never heard. All they had was growing up was the ABC and a country and western station. And I remember when Ray and I made the decision to do gay and lesbian only, which is what we called it, LGBTQI at the time. Valentine's Day, you get these absolutely touching letters from kids who are 17 years old and living, a hidden gay life in some small country town.
Well, Triple J in some ways was kind of like the internet before the internet.
In that
you could be a person who in your small place felt very alone, but you suddenly realised there were a whole bunch of people like you out there in the world, and you could actually sort of come together and you could kind of have some shared experience and learn from their shared experience.
Yeah, and you're also talking to the guy who made one of the great bad predictions of all time. In fact, it was on a mouse pad that was a Triple J souvenir. I was once quoted as saying, oh, the internet, you mean the CB radio of the 90s? Yeah, it didn't quite pan out that way, did it?
People are very fond of sending me a clip from the Glass House where I say, what's a podcast?
Yeah. So- yeah, I know. I mean, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker years ago which was two dogs in a backyard, and one turned to the other and said, I used to have a podcast, but I went back to howling at the moon. But now everyone's got a podcast.
So you mentioned Stuart Matchett, and I just want to briefly tell a Stuart Matchett story as well, because it's rare that you get the opportunity. Like, it's not like naturally someone like Stuart Matchett's name comes up on this podcast, but he was also, he was a great man of radio, Stuart.
Oh, unbelievable.
And just a very nice man, and a man that we both worked alongside, and was great. By the time that I got to Triple J, and I want to walk through all that, but by the time I got there, he was a great kind of older voice to be able to be supportive but also guide us in better directions and those sort of things. I had a lot of time for Stuart, and when he passed, I was actually shocked by the level of, sadness I felt, even though I hadn't really seen him much in, a long time.
I hadn't seen him in ages. I went to the funeral, and It was really moving. Absolute font of knowledge and information, Stuart. Also, too, and I say this with great love and affection, the teller of the longest anecdotes of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
I remember I actually walked into his office. He was staring out the window. He started telling a story. I walked across to another office, spoke to someone else, came back in, and he was still telling it. I love that about him. But, he's one of those guys that goes back to the punk era.
So I just wanted to tell a quick story because this this sums up Stuart Matcher, which is that so one day on the it was in the era where television shows all had uncut versions, you know, late night uncut versions, and we were in an era of that you couldn't dump, we didn't have a dump button in the studio like they have these days where you can put the show into delay if someone swears or says something inappropriate.
Well, I actually have to let you know you did have a dump.
Well, button. Yes, we didn't use the dump button. You're absolutely right. Yeah, the technology was installed.
We had the same thing. We never used it.
No. Well, I think often what also would happen was you'd use it, but then you can't put yourself back in again, so you'd go live for a while anyway. One day they had all these uncut shows on TV, and so I was doing a weather list, the old famous weather list, in between the weather around the country. You try to come up with some concept and, put a few jokes in between the weather.
I flogged that like a dying dog for 7 years.
Well, it was the first opportunity you guys gave me on your show, and Helen, was to come in and do a little weather list. So this day I was doing a weather list of other shows that should have uncut versions.
All right.
And one of the shows, there was a popular show at the time called Rex Hunt's Fishing Adventures or Fishing World.
Oh, yeah.
And so I tried to say Rex Hunt uncut. That is not what came out. It sounded a lot more like Rex Hunt's a cunt. And I remember it went to air and we didn't really get any complaints, but we were worried about what management would think. And Stuart Matchett came into the studio immediately after our shift, and he came in and he said, "If you guys ever say Rex Hunt on this radio station again," and I was like,
"Well, that's great.
Well, that's the sort of leadership and support that you needed."
I got done saying fuck a couple of times. One was very hungover one morning, and Razor was laying into me, and I just looked at him. "I don't fucking emasculate me, Razor." Which, I still stand by the statement.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't deter her in any way. Didn't put her off, though.
No.
If anything, she probably leaned in a little harder.
Yeah. I caught up with Helen while I was in Melbourne launching the book recently, and she was... she hasn't changed. It was great fun to see her, but she arrived late, and then she spoke for 40 minutes. But she was... that's Helen. And then she took me, and then we went out and had a fantastic Italian meal.
I'm going to go back to when I first sort of had an awareness of you guys, because I was at university, and it was my first year of university.
You were at Canberra, weren't you?
Canberra University, of Canberra. And I was living on campus, B block, old resis, and my RA at the time, who I later became very nice friends with, and we actually moved out together, lived in a share house with a bunch of other people. She loved Triple J, had really great taste in music and loved Triple J. And she was like, "Hey, like on Tuesday morning or whatever, you guys were doing a breakfast OB from the Uni of Canberra
bar." The Uni bar.
Right?
Oh, man.
So the first time that I ever heard Triple J was when I came along to watch you guys do a live breakfast OB at the Canberra Uni bar.
I think that might have been the one where I used to scull a can of beer.
Correct. Yes. And, it might seem like one of those things that seems, a bit juvenile when you look back on it, but I've got to say, it captured a young farm boy's imagination, Mikey.
Every time we did an OB at about 6:02, just before we went into the news, I'd walk out on stage and scull a can of beer. And then I remember my last year at Triple J, we were doing an OB from Wollongong University, and I walked on stage at 6:02 and sculled a can of beer, then walked off stage and threw it all up, and I went, "I'm getting too old for this." I always maintain this: it's time to leave Triple J when you can't scull a can of beer and you've lived through your third Scar revival.
Yeah, I only got, I think, I think I may have had maybe two Scar revivals.
Yeah, the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones were the death of me. I'm thinking, I just can't go through this chunk of shit anymore.
Yeah, that was the impression that I got.
Yeah.
But
I tell you what, folks, Brad's Will and I sitting here nursing hangovers, but the man is still quick.
Maybe straighten that microphone up a little bit. That's not your fault. It has started to prematurely sort of wobble downwards. Look, it's not a great setup.
Come on, you nicked these mic stands, didn't you?
No. These are bought. I actually, this one's nicked. The one that I'm using is nicked. Nicked from myself, from my own tour. We left because I take my own microphone stands on tour with me because I have a specific microphone stand that I like that venues don't normally provide. So we have one that travels with us.
Do you have a particular mic you like? I see we've got a couple of Shure SM58s here, haven't we?
Yes, we do, because it's the cheapest, like, best option. It's just your classic.
I met a bloke once who was a roadie for Cold Chisel, and he said the worst job he had to do was every night he had to clean out Barnes' SM58 microphone. It was just filled with spit and phlegm.
Well, the other night when I was at the Comedy Store, I noticed that the sink near the toilet backstage was filled with things that meant you couldn't wash your hands, which then made me think only of the fact that there'd been like 8 people on that lineup, all of whom had probably not washed their hands after they went to the toilet, and then we all go out and speak into that grotty little... Anyway. It's a glamorous business that we work in, isn't it?
Nothing like getting changed in a toilet to make you realise you've made it in show business.
Yeah, I have. It's funny because I have a specific stool, like literally that just happens. It could be any stool, but I just like this stool. So we travel with a stool, the stool that I like to perform with, and we travel with my microphone stand because it has it's a trigger one.
So I can see it.
If I push, there's a little kind of button up the top, like a little handle up the top, and if I push that in, I can move the microphone stand up and down. And venues don't provide that standard, so we have our own. That's my version of touring with a... It's not a lot of stuff, it is something.
It's not like the Rolling Stones. You know, there was a period where Keith Richards wouldn't go on stage unless there was a shepherd's pie cooked for him backstage.
Yeah, see, there's none of that. Yeah. I mean, you know, they often get me the beer I like. Like, they'll ask me what beer I like, and they'll get me the beer I like.
Van Halen, there was the story that Van Halen would insist in the list they gave out to promoters that there'd be no brown M&Ms in the bowl. It's a true story, and the reason they did it wasn't they didn't give a shit about brown M&Ms. They had a whole bunch of health and safety regulations for their crew. So if they figured out when they got there and there were brown M&Ms in the bowl, they hadn't read the health and safety regulations, and then they told the venue to go get fucked.
I mean, that is a good way of thinking about things. I like that. It's like putting something in the... It's like Apple putting something in their, you know, iTunes terms and conditions right in the middle. Yeah. That's real. In fact, they probably do that, actually. Yeah. So
It's like... And don't forget, if you're down more than 3 Sinead O'Connor songs, you've got to blow a donkey. What?
What? Hang on. What? Hang on. You signed it.
Yeah.
You said accept. You said you'd read them and accepted it.
It's like, okay, nothing compares to you. Why is there a donkey at my... Right.
Okay. Oh, well, I guess I still like iTunes. So.
Yeah.
All right. So I watch you guys do this show. Let's take it away from me and let's take it to you. So this podcast is called Philosophy, but it's only a loose conceit. But I do like to ask people the question whether they have a particular philosophy towards anything. And it doesn't have to be anything in particular. It could be a major life philosophy, or it could be a small philosophy. And, you know, when it comes to work or to love or to, you know, adventure or the way that you've lived your life, do you have any such thing?
Ape shall not kill ape.
That's good.
Actually, I was
you're the third person I've had on. He's gone with that as if
I thought as much. Yeah. Actually, no, I thought as much. I was thinking about this on the way in the cab over. And when I was 14, a guy called Jacob Bronowski made a documentary series called The Ascent of Man. He was a great mathematician and a humanist. And there's a scene where he's at Auschwitz, where a lot of his family had died, and he sticks his hand into the mud where they would wash out the ashes of the bodies. And he quotes Oliver Cromwell, who wrote a letter to the Scottish Parliament that contains the lines, "I beseech you within the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken." Now, for someone who was raised as a Catholic, to see that when I was 13... it still resonates with me now. And he goes on to say that it wasn't gas that killed these people, it was dogma. I suppose that's the philosophy I've had all my life, is I am terrified of people who believe in absolute truths, because people who believe in absolute truths are capable of crimes against humanity. So I prefer to live my life through a painful miasma of self-doubt, Will.
Yes, good. Well, that's the correct answer. If you'd gone the other way, we would have shut down the podcast pretty quickly.
Yeah, so, yes.
no, but I mean, that's an idea that responds to me because I often think, and I don't spend too much time worrying about what other people's misconceptions of me are, but in the moments where I am, or in the moments where I'm, you know, my own brain is prosecuting, you know, my own self-worth.
Mm.
The thing that I always come back to that I think that people misunderstand about me the most is that people who don't like me think I'm very certain about my opinions.
Really?
Yes, as in like people who, you know, like they're like, oh, you're just this. You just, you know, like, you know, believe this and you're like this. And that is a complete misunderstanding of who I am because I could not be more questioning and more uncertain and more, you know, racked by the belief that we should always be trying to make our best guess. I say it all the time when we're making gruen. I say, remember, we're all just trying to come up with our best guess. And at the end of the day, we might all still be wrong. But we just try our best to, like, you know, this idea that there is some sort of certainty or some sort of answer or... Mm. I mean, if I had certainty or an answer, I wouldn't have a podcast. I'd have a lecture series and I'd sell tapes afterwards. Well,
yeah, exactly. I'd
have a book.
You've worked with Ted Robinson. I've worked with Ted Robinson. Ted was EP on Glasshouse. He was EP on Good News Week.
The big gig.
I remember Ted saying to me once, he said, you put just as much time and effort and money into a program that fails than one that succeeds and you just never fucking know.
No.
And you don't. It's like, you know, you, before we start the podcast, you're trying out new gear at the moment and you're doing improv. And there's that moment where you go, this is going to kill it, and it gets nothing. And then a sad little throwaway line that you didn't even really think about, suddenly it gets a round of applause and you go, oh, I suppose I better keep that in.
Right.
I don't really, you know, so it is weird. You know, I always maintain that there are, the only other art form like comedy is pornography because they both require a physical reaction. and just as some porn works for some people and doesn't work for others, it's always the same with comedy. You never know what's going to stick.
The difference is that it's still appropriate to gather a whole bunch of people in a darkened room to enjoy comedy together, whereas pornography, that's still...
I remember years ago, I don't know how we ended up with this story... my flatmate and I were living in a flat, obviously, in Union Street, Newcastle, and a bunch of guys upstairs, and they used to get stoned and pissed and watch porn together. And I'm thinking, as a prelude to what? Mm. I mean, don't get me wrong, boys, if you want to, but no, they just, it's like, no, you really should be doing that on your own.
Mm. I just don't really like a plot-heavy story, you know? I'm more a visuals guy, yeah. So this is really...
I mean, it used to be so hard fast-forwarding. I really don't care how the basketball team raises money.
We didn't start, to be honest, with porn. We tried to find a movie that we all had in common.
Yeah.
We started with The Fast and the Furious. You know, Jerry likes art house stuff.
Yeah. Then suddenly, next thing you know, there's a donkey at the door. Hey, can I have some more water?
Oh, yes. And I've got some here.
Thanks, mate. That's okay. No, this is fascinating. Thanks, man.
So, we will cut none of that out because that's the way this podcast goes, basically. I want to ask you about that because...
Now what?
About, well, yes, exactly. I will get to that. So, the idea of, you know, best guess or that you never have a certainty about comedy and which bit of comedy is going to work. And you stumbled on something that I just, at the moment, am quite fascinated by, which is I do believe there are two very different states of comedy. And the one that you see most often, like on stage, is actually a comedy of two competing things almost, because it's a comedy of replication, right? So if you are doing your material, your act, you've tried it in a whole bunch of places and you've essentially done a focus group, right?
Oh, I gotcha.
And you focus group the exact... It's probably because, as you also know, I'm watching The West Wing at the same time.
Yeah.
So you know how sometimes thoughts connect in your mind?
Yeah.
But it feels like most stand-up comedy, the set you do at a gala or whatever, has been focus grouped through all those... You've tested in front of small audiences, in front of bigger audiences. You've reworded it. You've flipped that line.
It's your tight five.
Right. Okay. So you've got your tight five. Yeah. Your stump speech, you know, your go-to, right?
Yeah. But also, too, you've got three different versions of your tight five. You've got your tight five at a comedy room, you've got your tight five for a charity gig, and you've got your tight five for a corporate room.
Right, absolutely, right? Yeah. So Again, all focus tested, all designed to be for a specific audience, but you're taking that to the audience. Now, there's this other moment, the moment of creation, right?
Yeah.
Where you're actually, and you're, so I'm doing these improvised shows, but you have made your, you know, reputation as being, you know, one of the, you know, world's finest improvisers, being able to work off the top of your head.
Not on stage, though. I mean, radio and telly, I'm very comfortable.
Right.
But on stage, I find improvising on stage really hard.
Yes, but so this is what I'm saying. I feel like they're two very different states, and I just wanted your comment on that, because one of them, you know, you're on Good News Week, you're on the radio, you're this thing, you're creating something in the moment, and often, like you said, maybe that joke won't work because you thought it was going to work, but the line afterwards works even better because you're in the moment, you're creating something right there. Yeah, you're not replicating.
I know.
You're creating.
I'll never forget once on Good News Week, I sort of knew what the topics were going to be one night, and I rarely prepped, and I thought of this line, I thought, this is going to kill. And Paul said something, and I threw my killer line out. And then Anthony Morgan just leaned over in the silence and went, "Isn't it sad when sometimes a joke is just a sentence?" And you know, and it would come from one of the comedians I respect most in Australia. And the worst thing was, the fucker was right.
But that is, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think sometimes, and I would say this to people a lot in those environments, which is, sure, I mean, you know, if you have an opportunity to have a couple of lines in your pocket or whatever, you know, have them in your pocket. Yeah. That's a good thing to do to prepare for a show of some kind. But never then be going, how can I get these lines in the show? Go, play the show, listen. No. Make your jokes up on the spot, and if you ever get to the point where you need the jokes in your pocket, they're there. But if you walk away from the show and the jokes are still in your pocket, then it's probably been a really good show.
I mean, fabulous, but also too, I think it's, you know, it's a bit like music. Before you improvise, you actually have to know the tune first,
right?
The great improvisers are actually really good at the basics, the skills, the chops. It's the same with comedy. It's not just a matter of getting loose and rambling. You know, you got to know your chops.
Okay, so tell me, how should we go through this? Because there's so much I want to talk to you about. But let's start with now and work backwards, I reckon, rather than doing it the other way. So you've currently just written a book.
Yeah.
So now it's called Seven Deadly Sins
and One Very Naughty Fruit.
And the title came before the book, or does the book lead the title? I'm always interested in which way around that goes.
No, the working title was Sinful Food, because what it is, it's written by an ex-fat Catholic kid. It's a look at the most bizarre parts of culinary history, as seen through the prism of the seven deadly sins. Because, quite frankly, it's a bit like philosophy. It's a conceit. I needed to break up into chapters, but then I sort of found that actually worked. It's been kicking around. The idea's been kicking around for a while, and then I was in the position where I could say to my agent last year, I said, unless something comes along that's ridiculous, which one or two things did, I said, I'm going to spend a year writing it, which is completely different to anything else I've done in my life. Even the stand-up is collaborative in terms of you're there with an audience, there with other comedians. All radio and TV I've done is collaborative. I spent a year locked alone in a room just going, fuck, I hope this is going to work.
So tell me about that, because I'm fascinated by that process. So what did your year look like for a start? Just tell me, when did you write? Like, how did you write? Did you have a plan? Did you just do it when you felt like it? What does that look like?
Basically, you know me. Well, I have the self-discipline of a kid that's gotten into the red cordial. So I had to really, seriously, guys.
I mean, Mikey, I won't lie that wasn't part of my fascination of finding out how this book got written.
I actually spent 4 months researching it with books and shit and stuff. I sat down and made a list of topics and various things. Then I worked. I was actually my work day. I would, even though I've got a home office, I would shower and not shave. Yeah, sometimes I actually shave. I would shower and I'd change my clothes and I'd put work clothes on. And I worked till lunchtime, then I'd take a break, and then I would work till, I mean, let's face it, I worked from 9 till 4. It's not exactly exhausting. And I would set myself a limit of, I had to achieve at least 500 words a day. The goal was 1,000. And if I had a day where I wrote over 1,500 words, I could go to the pub.
Okay.
And that was it.
A nice little incentive scheme.
Yeah, it was. It was.
And yeah, like one of those parents who tells their kid if they get 100 in their HSC, they'll buy them a car.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like, it's 1,500 words, I'm going to the pub. And it was really weird. I did it 5 days a week. I sort of approached it like a job. So when I finished writing on a Friday, I would actually say I've got the weekend off now. Or I'd go and do a gig, do a stand-up gig.
Somewhere. But I think that's important because I can imagine that when you have a project that is kind of your main project, like actually cutting off some, not knowing when you're not working or when, you know, it is the weekend.
Yeah.
Because you're your own boss in some ways when it comes to the hours. So the idea of having to go, no, hang on, I still should make sure I have some time off this.
And particularly when you're as easily distracted as I am, you know. I mean, I have to, when I'm writing, it has to be complete silence. Like, I can't even have the telly or music on in the background. And it's very lonely. It was weird. I know all the shop owners in my street by first name because I could see the look on their face. Oh, here comes the lonely guy. He's just like, hi, James. So, what are the cherries like today? It's like, oh, just fuck. Don't you have? Look, my friends are working, and I'm in an office on my own, and I spent this morning researching about how the ancient Romans invented Gatorade, which they did actually. Please, can I talk to another human being?
Now, is the ancient Romans inventing Gatorade in the book?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so give me a little, because I'm fascinated by, give me a little about that.
Well, actually, when you talk about the process, because a lot of the stuff was researched beforehand, but of course nowadays with the net.
Yeah.
And that was an example of starting off in one place and ending up somewhere completely different. I was actually I was researching a bit about how modern molecular chefs are using ash to give an extra carbonized flavor to their dishes.
Yep.
Then, after a couple of hours of disappearing down the wormhole of the internet, I actually found out that in 1933, they found a bunch of gladiator skeletons, and they knew they were gladiators because of the wounds. In 2012, they did some testing on these skeletons and found they had a really high level of electrolytes. So they then went back to the writings of Plato, and they found out that Plato had mentioned a drink that the gladiators drank, which was a mixture of vinegar, wine, ash, and various herbs that was high in electrolytes. So it's true. 2,500 years ago, gladiators invented the world's first sports drink.
I mean, I've got to be honest with you. That sounds much more delicious than modern-day sports drinks.
Oh, man.
Like, if I was a bar and somebody, like, offered me some sort of, like, wine, apple cider vinegar, ash cocktail.
Man.
Maybe some organic vodka or something in that, you know? Some ice in that glass.
I'd be bang up for it. I mean, like, what's not quite as nice? Because I know you like a beer. The ancient Sumerians, the first beer they made was more like a porridge. So they invented the straw because it had a filter at the bottom. So imagine sucking in a beery McDonald's thick... hang on, that's a great idea.
Well, that's not a bad idea.
That's not a bad idea at all.
Well, actually, when we were at high school, probably shouldn't say this, I'm sure the statute of limitation of teen drinking and sale is probably gone by now, but we used to be very big on, we'd get a little, those sort of, you know, mini bar bottles of like Kahlua.
Yeah.
And we would put them in McDonald's thick shakes. Delicious.
I was, I'm going to top that. This is disgusting. I was on the school debating team, and the school debating team used to make our own Baileys.
Bootleg Baileys.
Bootleg Baileys. For that, you get it's disgusting. You get a flagon bottle.
Yep.
The cheapest bottle of scotch. Well, the bottle of scotch you could afford.
Yep.
So you'd pour that in, then you'd pour in a couple of tablespoons of Quick, the chocolate pepper.
That is one of the key ingredients of Baileys.
It gets worse. It gets worse, Will. Two tins of condensed milk, a bit of vanilla essence, and you top it up with milk, and you'd shake it. That was that's quite reprehensible.
That's pretty hilarious. The things that you cook, like I remember at uni. Because we were all just like, you know, proper uni students, bad diets, and well, my diet hasn't improved much, but, you know, just like living that sort of like unhealthy, finally out of home, you can eat what you want to eat, sort of thing. And I remember one day, And it was like such a production, but it was worth it, every bit of it. We hollowed out a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
And then we filled the loaf of bread with like pizza ingredients, so like cheese and all the things you'd put in like, you know, a pizza. And then we put it like all back together. And then we put batter around the outside of the bread, and then we deep fried the whole thing and cut it into slices. So it was like a deep fried pizza sandwich.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
Stoned?
I mean, possibly. Oh, you mean now?
Elvis is. I didn't realize this. Elvis was actually over close to 160 kilos when he died. But one of his favorite snacks was the sandwich made in Tupelo. No, not Tupelo. But somewhere around there.
Okay.
And you take a loaf of white bread, you hollow it out. You then smother it in margarine, not butter, margarine. You stick that in an oven until it's crispy. You fill one of the half hollowed out bits with peanut butter. You fill the other hollowed out bit with like a plum jelly, or jelly as they call it. And then in between, before you reassemble it, you'd put a pound of crispy bacon. And Elvis was once known to eat four of them in one sitting. It's a pomper pomper no more.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, because you are a man who like has loved, you know, to have a great meal.
Oh,
do you know
shit,
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Do you remember your favorite meal you've ever had? Do you have like one that would come to mind if you were like, if I get to recreate one meal again, what would it be?
Yep. That's easy. It was my honeymoon. And Laura and I were in Kyoto and we're having a huge fight. She wanted to find this yakitori thing in the guidebook and I couldn't find it. And reached that point where it was like, oh, I'll see you back at the hotel. And then there was like a little tiny restaurant, barely a restaurant. It had like six stools just near the river, just near one of the bridges that go across the Kyoto River. And we went down there and they served one dish, which was a river fish that had been caught, dried, then rehydrated, and then quickly fried in a light tempura batter. And Laura looked at it, and like it was teeth heads and all. Laura's not big on that. It was, I can still taste it to this day. It was absolutely beautiful. And there was a middle-aged Japanese woman sitting a few doors down from us, and the guy behind the counter and his wife, she was doing the cooking. And he turned to us and he said, English. I said, Australian. He said, Australian. He said, business. And I pointed to my wedding ring. I said, no, honeymoon. And he said, honeymoon. He then took away our beers and brought up a bottle of Chivas Regal in the ceramic bottle. And within about 10 minutes, the fish was great. Within about 10 minutes, he and I were doing an Elvis medley on the karaoke machine. And then the woman who had been sitting quietly came over and said in broken English that to celebrate our wedding, she wanted to sing a Japanese wedding song to us, which she found on the karaoke machine. And in the middle of this tiny bar, my wife and I closed dance while she sang. So it's not just the food, but that to me, if anyone asks what's the best meal of my life, it was that night. And it was 19 years ago. We're married 20 years next year. And we're going to go back to Japan.
What is that like, being married for 20 years? You know, were you a person that you always imagined that you would, like, did you grow up thinking I'll get married at some stage, that'll be something that I do in my life? Like, what was your attitude to that stuff?
Well, I remember when I was a teenager thinking, you know, one day I'll have a wife and I'll never have to masturbate again. And
how'd that work out?
And now after 20 years of marriage, I go, is this woman ever going to leave the fucking house?
I've got to do some research.
Yeah, honey,
some ancient foods.
You that thing, you go to the shops, how long are you going to be?
Yeah.
What time are you coming home? Yeah.
What possible reason would you need to know that?
Yeah. It was like, oh, I just want to know if I can get comfy in front of the computer or spank one out on the couch.
So the idea of, I guess it goes to that idea of, you know, certainty versus the idea of that no one really knows, you know. So if you are a person who, you know, you said that, you know, raised Catholic, you know, the book's called The Seven Deadly Sins. Like, I mean, it's themed around the seven deadly sins. So clearly religion still has some sort of, you know, even there is a part of it that clearly resonates with the way that you are looking at the world. So talk to me about that.
I suppose the structure of it, which is something I both reject and miss. I would say I miss that.
Okay, that's an interesting thing to say.
I'm just saying to I have friends who are devout Catholics, and I say, look, there's a part of me that envies your faith.
Right.
But I don't want it. But there's a part of me that still envies your faith. Yeah, it's. I suppose there's that thing. Were you raised religious?
You know what? Semi-religious. Dad's not religious. Mum's mum is religious, and so mum took us to church and stuff, and you know whatever for Nan. You know when we were young, and there was a time I've spoken about this on stage before, but there was a time when I was young where I wanted to be a priest, and you know mostly in reflection, it was the you know. Public speaking, the attentive audience, and the fact that they wear black, which is always good to wear on stage.
Yeah, I know, because it doesn't show the sweat. I always wear black on stage. And you're right, though, that sense of theatre. Yeah. And the sense of theatre from the Mass, I used to find interesting. I used to hate getting the communion wafer stuck to the roof of my mouth because we were told you couldn't use your finger to get it down. You have to use your tongue. I don't know why. Let's just not go into any of the jokes. I can see the look on your face, Will.
It's a difficult topic at the moment, Mikey.
Yes, indeed.
I don't want to have to redact the next 40 minutes of this podcast.
Yes. the news story no one can actually talk about.
Yeah, but everybody seems to know about because I guess the legal system hasn't adapted to modern-day communication. Let's have a little pause just so that I can get you a fresh drink and I'll stretch my legs just for a second and we'll get back. Yeah, I could see one day, and then I was like, I can't really see. Well, I got to the point where, as they say, I ran out of arm.
Yeah.
So I was putting things further and further away to be able to see them, and then I've got specs, and someone said to me, by the way, the one thing that you need to know when you've got reading glasses is you immediately need them. Like, once you start using them, you kind of will need them all the time, and I've been amazed by that. I am blind now if I don't have my glasses on to read things.
No, I've got a pair of reading glasses. I use them if I'm... When I'm writing, I use them a bit because I do a lot of research on my phone.
Yeah. I've become a glasses... because we have cameras in the radio studio, and what I've realised is when I see little clips they play back is I gesticulate with my glasses a lot. I'm one of those.
Oh, like turn.
I'm very.
Actually, I was in your studios a few weeks ago. I did a spot with Mick and Jane. They sound good. They sound really good.
Good radio pros, aren't they? So, who did you have radio role models before you sort of like you know were started doing radio yourself? Because I mean, I grew up listening to you and Helen, but I listened to Martin Malloy and, you know, you hear Andrew talk about listening and working for Doug Mulray. Those sort of things. So who was it for you?
Mulray. Mind you, I never heard Mulray if I was in Sydney. In Newcastle, we had a whole bunch of jocks who did...
Which was the name of the breakfast show? A whole bunch of jocks.
A whole bunch of, you know, Winger, Dinger and the Magpie. You know?
Dinger was good, though.
Yeah. Oh, don't go there, Magpie. Too late, he already has.
Oh, Dinger.
Yeah, Dinger, mate. Oh.
By the way, there is an element of that style of radio, you know, the old cliche style of radio of, oh, Dinger.
Oh, my.
Like, to me, that I find very, very listenable. I was, like, in an Uber last night, and it was some sort of, like, nighttime show where the jock was just way too jockey, and I was... Loving it. It sounded like a Tony Martin podcast. I was loving it.
I was telling you before we started, I'm off to a radio friend of ours' birthday party tonight, which will be full of mate. Everyone went to announce the school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there'll be a lot of... So that's something that I would like to talk to you about because I think that I saw you as a great role model because... Both of us don't have what you would call traditional radio voices, and we certainly don't have, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, we both often, our thoughts are working almost quicker than our mouths can work, and things come out in fits and starts and half sentences.
Very much so, yeah.
Explosions and these sort of things.
Yeah.
And I, you know, before that it was very jockey. So was there any pushback against like your style of broadcasting?
Very much so. particularly when I started working at commercial. They went, mate, slow down. I was like, yeah. sorry, excuse me. I keep saying, do you hide me? You know, you've been listening to me on the ABC for 3 years now. You know what I'm like. My voice has gotten deeper as I've gotten older. It's probably just because of smoking. But I mean, that's what I still to this day am very proud of with Helen and I. We didn't have radio voices. And also too, you know, when we're talking about, you know, don't go there, it was often Helen was the one who would go where it was, oh, raised, don't go there. You know, there was a thing in radio at the time where if a woman was on, it was her role to either giggle or be shocked.
Right.
And Helen was definitely not that.
Well, see, sometimes, you know, you look at change as being gradual change, you know, as in like you eventually move the giggler into a more substantial role and then it eventually becomes some sort of equal partnership. But that wasn't Helen Razor's style. No. Helen Razor's style was like, this has all been bullshit so far and I am going the complete opposite direction to that.
Mind you, having said that, Wendy Harmer was established at the time too, and Wendy's, you know, was you know, unbelievably successful career.
Well, yeah, and you know what? Like, I mean, I've spoken many, many times on this podcast, and Wendy and I have actually spoken many times about the fact that we would get together and do one of these at some stage. But, yeah, Wendy was a great role model to me because the Big Gig was a really instrumental sort of show in my household when I was, like, you know, 14, 15. And to see Wendy, who was the ringmaster of this thing, host this show, I've spoken many times on this podcast before about the fact that I still don't quite understand. And I think it's why Australia was a little late to the table in acknowledging, you know, the lack of sort of equality stage time, and still are in the stand-up scene and stuff. You'd know this from doing gigs. It's still
it's better than it was.
It's better than it was, but it's still not 50-50. But I remember, see, I never just imagined that. Like, I overlooked some of the things that should have been obvious in front of me because so many of my role models in comedy were strong women, you know, whether it be Wendy Harmer or whether it be Judith Lucy
Jean Kitson
or Linda Gibson or Sue Ann Post or, you know, the Melbourne scene in particular when I was coming up through there was dominated by, like, you know, impressive, you know, women who strong. Were equally regarded as the men in the scene. So I think for a while, you know, I was distracted by the fact that at that top end of it, it felt... But then you look at what Wendy did with the Big Gig, and then you look at what did that go to? Like, it didn't create, you know, 30 years of, like, strong women like Wendy getting to host TV shows.
No, it's ridiculous. Yeah, but you mentioned Big Gig. My first ever money I made for selling a joke was the Big Gig.
Can you remember the joke?
Yeah, I can. Angela Moore had a suburban housewife character called Shirley Purvis, and she gave me $100 to. Gag doctor one of her scripts.
Yeah.
And there was one about a fat guy wearing shorts, his bum looked like two inner tubes having an argument. That was it. But
that's still a lovely line.
I still use that one, mate. It's why I don't wear lycra. And the other one too was she had a bit about.
I mean, inner tubes are inherently amusing.
Well, I know.
It's such a good choice of, like, thing to make because you can make that joke. Hmm. Like, the beauty of that joke is not the joke that you're making; it's the language with which and the image that you've evoked of that thing that you could have gone with a bag of potatoes or something. Nowhere near as inspired or as interesting as that. That's a great use of language.
And the other one too was she and her husband Barry were having a fight over a game of Scrabble, and she needed a joke to go in there. And I still stand by this one. I had to convince Barry that Cracker Fat is not a town in Poland. See?
Yes. I mean, look.
Cracker Fat, come on.
It's got a bit of international politics, but also it's got a Cracker Fat
jacket. It's got a Cracker Fat jacket. Getting back to inner tubes, one thing inner tubes told you when you were a kid was you couldn't afford as good water toys as the other families. Right. It's like, oh, they've got surfboards and surfboards. We've got an inner tube. Are we poor, Dad?
Did you grow up? What would you consider the manner in which you grew up? Like, you know, from a financial, like, were you working class people? Were you middle class people?
Dad was a traveling salesman.
Uh-huh.
Seriously, he was. But he died when I was 10, so I was raised by mum, my sister and I, and she worked at Kmart. So that was, you know, that's pretty, you know. We did not have a lot of money. I mean, and the suburb, the school I went to, was a combination of poorer suburbs and richer suburbs, and I was very aware of the fact that my friends had more money than we did. I'll never forget. I think I was 12 before I saw my first avocado. I went to a friend's place for dinner and they had an avocado and I didn't know how to eat it. And about the same age before I realised that ham didn't come out of a tin with a key, which is what ham was. But then give Mum a juice. She left the job at Kmart and she went back to uni and she became a teacher. But by that stage, I was out of the house.
So tell me what your relationship with money has been like, because I'm always interested in people who come from, like, because you got to a point where, you know, certainly for a considerable period of time, you had a very good run where you had a whole bunch of jobs that, you know, without needing to go into any of the details, people can just go, if you've got a hit TV show and you've got a hit radio show,
yeah.
You know, you've got some money coming through. More money than a family raised, you know, on a teacher's or Kmart wage, you know, is ever going to see. So I want to know what your relationship to money is like.
I'm useless. Yeah. I got to be honest, Will, I'm useless. Thank Christ for Laura. I'll wake up on a Monday, I open my wallet and I go, oh, look, the Amex is back. I've been a good boy. heaven forbid I should say this. If something was to happen to my wife tomorrow, I got no idea where the money is.
Yeah, right.
I just, every now and then...
It's a good incentive to keep being nice to her, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every now and then some papers appear in front of me with sign here stickers, and I go, okay, that sounds good. That's good. having said that, you know, we will sit down from time to time and have long-term objectives discussions. But now I'm, you know, I've said it before, if it wasn't for Laura, I'd be living in a dumpster. Well, not a dumpster.
Well, no, you wouldn't be living in a dumpster. You'd be living in a series of, like, because you, like, a person like you, I always, this is, I mean, again, sometimes this podcast is, you know, it's called Willosophy, and I talk about me as much as I talk about anything else. But, and I know some people don't like that, but, you know, whatever. There's heaps of podcasts out there, so find your own choices.
Yeah, fuck it.
No, but I always think that comedians, particularly the style of comedians we are, you know, where you can do panel or you can be a radio host or you can kind of apply your comedic skills to a bunch of things. We're kind of like card players going town to town where you'd find a game.
Yeah.
Right? You wouldn't be living in a dumpster because what you'd be doing is you'd be a traveling salesman going town to town looking for a game that you could get involved in and you'd make your way.
Yeah. And, you know, you can't just do one thing. I used to maintain we live like pirates,
right?
A little bit too. And the good thing is Laura knows where the treasure's buried and I don't.
Yeah, it's good to have a backup plan.
Yeah,
if you're kidnapped, you can't leave them to the treasure.
No, it's like, you know, honey, where are those Spanish doubloons? I'm not telling you. Okay, fine. That's all good.
Makes you passionate about your work? Like, what is it that when you're like really enjoying it, you know, when you're not, yeah, you know, I mean, because we do this as our way we make our living, which means that not every bit of it is, you know, as enjoyable as other bits, right? Some of it's just hard work or boring or, you know, monotonous.
It's not really, mate.
Meetings or no, but I mean,
oh, that bit, I loathe meetings. I loathe meetings.
There are some elements of it that, I mean, not by the standards of having a real job.
You've had a real job.
Yeah, I've had a real
job. I've had a real job.
Yeah, I've had several real jobs and I do not recommend them.
I was a dishwasher. And man, that is hard work.
Yeah.
That was hard work.
No, I've often said that my worst day doing this is still better than my best day doing anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I've now reached an age where I actually can't do anything else.
Me neither.
I've been doing it so long.
I'm still qualified to go back to journalism, but journalism went away while I was doing this.
Yeah. I found myself in the position of, I've written a book, which is it's the same job, except it's done on your own. But it's why do it? I just like, I like making people happy, and maybe that fills a hole in me. It fills a hole in you. I don't know, but there is. I mean, I think Steve Abbott once said that that laughter is the hug that only strangers can give.
And there is
something nice about, you know, being writing something or performing something and someone you have never met, you connect with them and they find that entertaining, and that fills a void.
It's interesting. I'll give you a different spin on that from my perspective, which I think absolutely I understand that 100%. You talk about that hole that it feels in me, and there's probably one that I don't recognize or know, right? You know, there's probably one that, like, you know, but like I've been going to a lot of therapy and stuff and trying to actually examine what it is that I get out of that and what the connection is, because what I have felt like was when I first started, I really did feel like what I was getting out of it was that in that moment, I was having a connection with the audience, right? I was saying something and they were connecting to my idea through laughter, and that was about us. And I was saying to my therapist, I was saying, I think that I don't feel that the same way anymore. But I said, is this a weird thing to feel? I think that the joy that I get isn't out of me connecting with other people, because I don't feel like that's something that I need in my life anymore for my ideas to be validated. Go into your theory that I've kind of submitted myself to the idea that I don't know. I don't know what the truth is. So having my ideas validated in that way it isn't quite as important to me. Oh, yeah. Or maybe it's just because I have a whole bunch of opportunities for my ideas to be in that, and I'm just like, you know, I'm a man who like eats 8 meals a day and goes, I'm never hungry. I don't know what you're talking about. You know what I mean? Like maybe that's the case. I don't know. But what I actually enjoy more is there are rare things these days where a group of – because people don't even go to the movies that much right? Where a group of strangers will come together and they can be completely different. In my front row the other night, there was a 13-year-old kid and a 93-year-old woman in the front row, separated by one person, right?
So, you know, that's what's wrong with Tinder.
So, wish I'd thought of that joke at the time. But I, the point being that you're making a connection between some people who wouldn't ordinarily necessarily connect. And I get joy out of their connection with each other almost more than I get out of joy out of with my connection with them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It doesn't sound quite as needy as my theory, but no, I... Yeah,
I may be oversimplifying, but I feel like...
I can see what you're talking about, that idea of why are these people in this room? Why? And what is it? Because, you know, the comic device of the callback.
Right.
And what the callback does...
Oh, Mikey, I've relied on it heavily throughout my career. What are you talking about?
It's when you set something up and then you repeat it. What you're actually doing is creating a sense of community within the room. It's like, oh, I know what he's talking about. We heard that earlier. And so that, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, you do whether you're writing, whether you're on telly or on radio, is you're trying to establish a sense of community between your listeners or viewers or readers.
Tell me... if you had to look back and say, right, I reckon this was when I was having the most fun. This was like, because sometimes at the time you don't realize it, right? It's only when you reflect back and you go, I reckon that was it for me. That was the time where I was, doesn't mean it was the most successful point of your life. For me, I can easily identify it. The most fun I ever had was the couple of years just before my career properly broke. Like I was in Melbourne, I was living in North Carlton. Me and all my friends, there was a whole bunch of us, like Husey and Rove and Hellier and Corinne and, you know, Michelle Laurie and Tripod and all these guys who were all about the same age.
Yeah.
We would do shows together. You know, we do Jedwood's Elbow Grease and we'd all come with new material and we were all on the way. It felt like things were kind of, but we weren't quite there yet. And it was still to this day the happiest time of my life. Like, I loved it. Like, even though we all were so ambitious to stop living that life and live the life that we all now lead, it was such a wonderful time. Do you have a time that you remember as being like that?
I've been incredibly lucky my whole life. But I think one of the times I was really, really happy was when Good News Week came back. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm still very proud of the first shows. But when we came back, you have those moments when you know you're peaking. And I remember thinking, because I was the healthiest I've ever been in my life, and I was really enjoying doing the show, and because the thing was, when it came back, it was only supposed to come back as 8 specials because there was a hole in Channel 10's programming because of the writer's strike in America, and it ended up running for three and a bit years when it came back, which I wasn't expecting. I was doing radio at the time. I was doing Brecky on Vega, which is now Smooth. This week, I don't know. It was just a lot of fun. It was a lot. And the funniest thing too was, because I was down at 95 kilos, Paul couldn't make fat jokes, but I could still make short jokes. which is weird, because it's a weird thing about McDermott. He's actually, we're about the same height. But he just looks little. He just looks like...
It's like John Howard. John Howard, the former Prime Minister of Australia.
John Howard and Keating were the same height.
Yeah, yeah. He,
no one ever...
Everyone thinks of John Howard as being little Johnny, but he wasn't actually that
little. No. Paul's one of those guys, you know, every time you look at him, you think there's a ceramic mushroom not being sat on.
Maintaining long-term friendships that are also long-term creative relationships. Tell me about that.
That's a really interesting one. And there was one moment. You mentioned Paul. I saw Paul the other night, and I don't see enough of Paul. I really don't. I miss him.
No, I got to see him recently at a birthday party, and we spent a considerable amount of the night riffing on the fact that he did not find me conventionally handsome, and that I'd never been conventionally handsome, and that it, through any prism throughout history in which people had measured aesthetic worth, I would never be handsome.
See, I've always thought he was gorgeous.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I've always liked you slightly more.
Yeah, I know. But everyone does. It was funny. I mentioned doing Vegas during the breakfast show. Tony Squires has probably been my longest friend. We've known each other since university. And we've been on each other. Yeah, he had the fat. I would appear on that. Good news week. Tony would come. So we'd been on each other's shows. And long story short, I came in to fill in one morning when he was doing breakfast on Vega, and that went well, and they offered me the job. And Tony and I went out and had a drink, and I said, look, we've never worked together before. And he went, yeah. I said, how do you feel about it? He said, I'm not quite sure. I said, neither am I. I said, and you know this, no matter how much you personally love the people you work with, you're going to argue over something at some stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if you don't...
There's something wrong.
And I've spoken about this before, because I think that I, like, traditionally prefer to work with people that I'm not, real-life friends with. Or, you know, like...
Yeah.
It doesn't mean not friendly with. I don't want to, like... But I actually have found that when I do work with people... When Limo and I did the radio together, I actually found it really hard to have those arguments that you should be having to make the show better, because... He's my mate, and I don't want to have an argument with my mate. Whereas sometimes if that other person is just someone you work with, you can have the argument that needs to be had.
I did a radio show on a digital channel for a couple of years, about 2 years almost, with Ian Rogerson, who's one of my best mates as well. But that was fine, because Ian's the sanest person in show business. Ian is just the most normal, rational human being. And so, which is sort of, I don't think I've ever seen Ian lose his temper. I think when you spend a lot of years working with Jono, you build up some resilience.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, how much of, you know, who you are do you think is shaped by the people around you versus, you know, yourself? So I've often found the way that that I have become as a performer, you know, say in a radio studio, part of how I became was a reaction to the splitting of roles and the splitting of attitudes that Adam and I had. So I wasn't fully formed in that role, because Adam had the sort of intellectual, sort of, you know, well-spoken mathematics,
numbers.
So what the show needed was a little bit more sort of...
Humanity?
Yeah, well, just playing down of it, just being a bit more accessible to the audience stuff. So in a balance like that, you lean into it a bit. Like, I often wonder if I'd landed the other way around, where I had been the person who was filling the more intellectual role, how that would have shaped me perhaps in a different way.
Actually, it's funny, because this has been going through my mind recently, because I've been out promoting the book, which means I could start the morning on the Triple M breakfast show, and then I would go and do work with Richard Feidler.
Yep.
And then, and I knew completely that if I was in with the guys from the Triple M breakfast team, I was Mikey. And then when I was with Richard, I was very much more, you know, I was like, you know what's required of you in different environments. So, you know, I sort of know that if I'm going to talk to the guys on Triple M, we're going to crack a few fart jokes, a few poo, you know, and there are plenty of fart jokes in the book. But then, you know, so...
When you go to talk to Richard Feidler, you realize that he's going to know more about your life than you actually do yourself.
Oh. Actually, Richard was a weird one too, because Richard's someone who I would describe as a close acquaintance. I mean, I would probably see Richard once or twice a year.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, but so I know him well enough that I know him. And then, of course, he and I have the connection of both having spent a fair amount of our lives gaff taped to Paul McDermott.
Yep.
And so being in a bit, like, it's funny, you and I don't see each other that much. But I feel because of our shared history that I know you more than I know Richard.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And but it was a really interesting conversation. He's
a very good interviewer.
He's fantastic, actually.
It's often what I like to say to people who complain about this podcast is, there's already a good podcast where people interview people. It's called Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Yeah, you should listen to it.
Nah. I like to have a completely different approach. That's the one where you get all the information about the person. This is the one where I ignore that stuff and talk about what the best meal you ever had was. I think that is much more interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Feidler probably didn't ask you about the best meal of your life, did he?
No. Okay, I'm going to ask you, what was the first album you ever bought? Yeah.
Oh, did he ask you that?
No, I'm asking you.
Oh, okay. I know exactly the first albums I bought.
Yeah.
I know the first album that I obsessively, like, I'll give you this in two steps.
Yeah.
Andy Buck's sister, Helen. Andy Buck was a friend of mine. They were an American family who'd come out to Australia, and they were the coolest because, you know, they always had, like, American products in their fridge and stuff, French's, like, mustard and shit like that you thought was cool when you were a kid. And she gave me a cassette tape. Well, Andy gave me the cassette tape, Beastie Boys on one side and Run DMC on the other side, and I would have, like, played that until it sounded like Peter Harvey Canberra rapping, you know.
Wow.
No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
That's so much cooler than mine.
The first ones I bought.
Yeah.
I got it was Christmas vouchers.
Yeah.
I had enough for three cassettes, and I bought three cassettes at the same time. So I don't know which counts as but it's a real journey, and that's what I'm going to take you on now.
Okay, what do you got?
Okay, I'll start with the coolest. Yeah. The Cure, Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah, brilliant.
Right, okay. If I stop there, that'd be a really cool
but
place.
But you're not going to stop there, are you?
I am not. Now, this next one, I would still argue very heavily that you is still a great album.
You can justify this one, can't you?
Yeah, Paul Simon's Graceland.
Yep.
Good albums too,
100%, 100%.
Right? I mean, I probably bought it just on the back of You Can Call Me Al, but I grew to love it as an
funny
album.
Funny film clip with Chevy Chase.
Exactly. And last but not least, John Farnham's Whispering Jack. So that was my three.
Okay.
It's a real journey.
It's like whenever you see people in a spa bath, one of them doesn't belong.
It's like, hang on, who brought this guy? Who's Whispering Jack over here?
Try and understand it.
Yep. What was yours?
The world of Cat Stevens. Showing my age here. I really liked the Teeth of the Tillerman and those sort of folksy hits that he had when I was about 8 or 9. And so I went to the local Coles and there was a Cat Stevens album and I had enough money to buy it. Unfortunately, before he became the sensitive singer-songwriter, Cat Stevens was a pretty ordinary R&B singer. And what I had bought was a compilation of his failed hits before he became. So I got it home and the only song that people might remember is Matthew and Son. The rest is absolute shit. It's dreadful. I was seriously let down by the first album I ever bought. It was horrible.
That's really funny. That's like when my friend Peter Shepherd bought Extremes album, because remember they had that ballad More Than Words. But the rest of their stuff was not like that.
No,
the rest of their stuff was like really heavy, sort of like metal. It was not his to his toast.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like buying the album by the neck.
All right, that microphone is escaping again. Can you just straighten it a bit?
Got it.
We need to start to finish up.
Good.
But
I'm not good. I'm lovely seeing it, but yeah.
Sure. No.
I said it a bit too quickly,
Come out a little quickly. Good.
Yeah, good.
All right. Okay. Well, it turns out we do. I was really just being polite and was going to bang on for a bit longer. I want to ask, there's a couple of key things that I always get to here, which is we've touched on one a little bit already, which is religion. But do you have any, so if you kind of have walked away from, you know, your Catholic beliefs,
yeah.
have you replaced those beliefs by any sort of thoughts about what you believe life, you know, is about? Do you have a set of beliefs by which you sort of guide your life? What do you understand the nature of our, you know, existence to be? Just if you could just summarize that in about 15 seconds, that'd be.
I have no idea.
Do you think about it?
No.
Do you think about why you're here?
I honestly don't.
Never.
It's crossed my mind.
But you don't sit around every day and go, what is the purpose of my existence?
Absolutely not.
Why are we human beings, this accident in the corner of the universe? Why do we exist? What am I doing? That doesn't cross your mind.
No. Oh, I'm sorry, mate.
What a lovely life you lead.
I know. I mean, you know,
That's a perfectly legitimate answer, and I think it's probably...
I don't think about it.
It's probably the most sensible answer, because none of us can actually, understand the nature of our existence.
I have this thing that if I start asking questions, I'd like to have an answer at some stage.
Yeah.
And for that, I know there's no answer, so I'll just keep going.
Okay, so what then, and that leads us to the next bit, do you think about death? You know, do you think about what happens when you die? Is death something that is present in your mind?
Oh, constantly.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. No,
well, one out of two. That's fine.
Yeah, I morbidly obsess about death. I think, I've seen someone die. I saw my father-in-law pass away in hospital. And there is... We die.
Mm.
I mean, I think I'll be fine because once it's happening, there'll reach a point where I won't exist anymore and I won't know it's happened. I don't believe in an afterlife because I'm fucking sick of this one. I'm not sick of this one. That sounds too depressive. But, you know, once around's enough.
Yeah.
Once around's enough.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's actually... do you think about what... you would like to. I'm not one of those people at all who cares about, like, literally once I'm dead, if you just want to toss me off the side of a boat or something, I don't care. Whatever is best, burn me in the backyard or whatever's environmentally friendly, recycle me or feed me to homeless people or whatever you need. Take some bones, take some organs. None of them will be much good, but, like, you know, whatever you want. Like, I'm dead now. But some people think a lot about, like, oh, no, I'd like it to be a big party or I'd like to sort of, like, you know, have you thought about that? Do you want to be buried, cremated? Like, do you ever think about any of those things?
Dump from a moving car?
I mean, that'd be fun, wouldn't
that'd
it?
That'd be cool,
just
wouldn't
for
it?
Fun.
Just to freak people out.
Just, exactly. It's his last wish, guys. Come on.
We're going to wrap him in a blanket.
From the back of a Black Thunder.
Yeah.
We'll get Triple M to bring the car.
And we're just going to roll him out of a moving car. Either that or a full Viking funeral. I'm easy either way.
I mean, that'd be great.
That'd be cool.
But with a Viking feast afterwards,
I'm going to use something environmentally responsible. One thing I have learnt from as you get older, you attend more funerals, and I've been pallbearer. Coffins are fucking heavy.
Yeah,
and
don't put your friends through that. They're already having a bad day.
Yeah, exactly. And the worst one was actually at my father-in-law's funeral. I was on the right-hand side of the coffin, and so I had it in my left hand, and I was wearing my wedding ring. And here's a little hint, if you're planning a funeral, don't get hexagonal grips on the coffins because it caught under my wedding ring and almost broke my finger. At one point, I thought I was actually going to have to swap hands and go down backwards, which would not be a fitting memorial.
I mean, well, at least I guess someone in the room would be having a worse day.
Yeah. There is that. Quite frankly, there'll be no one around for my funeral because I intend to bury you all.
Okay, I hope that's the case too. I intend to die young.
As Paul McDermott would say, die young but not leave a classically handsome corpse.
Yes. So, Mikey, at the moment, the book. Also, what else? Tell me what else is going on in your world.
I'm promoting the book. Bizarrely enough, for me, I enjoyed the process so much of writing, and it seems to be being well received enough that I'm
going
to
do another one.
I'm about 20,000 words in.
Okay, great.
And I've got a bit more research to do, and I've promised myself that I will actually. We talked about this before. I look at this as a job. I'm going to keep working up until I can take some time off from it in January.
Tell me this. Is there anything that you haven't done? Because I look at your life and I think, you know, you've written and you've improvised and you've done stand-up and you've, been involved in successful TV shows and radio shows and worked with, you know, everybody there is to work with in the industry at some stage or time. Is there something still left? Is there an itch left unscratched?
Yeah. I did drama at uni and I did some plays and I wasn't bad. I wouldn't mind doing a straight acting role. I wouldn't mind having a crack at that.
I mean, people have been accusing you of being straight acting for many years.
Yes, so I see.
I feel like that was for the non-classically handsome.
No, I wouldn't mind having a crack at acting.
I see. I could definitely see that. See, that's a good next. Yeah, write books and then just do like get some like, surely on the reboot of Sea Change they could have a
gnarled old shipping captain or something
exactly.
Like that. Yeah, or a drunk, like a cranky old drunk.
Yes, there's got to be a role for that.
Yeah.
You know?
If anyone out there is listening, you know, a cranky old drunk, I'm just pop into the Lord Dudley. I'm there most days.
Do you know what? I think Australia's crying out for a new Bill Hunter. And, you know?
Yep.
It's been a respectful amount of time, for Bill's legacy. But what we really are missing now is a guy who takes all these phone calls from the pub.
Yep.
And wanders onto set, possibly drunk at the time, and gives the best performance in the entire thing.
I would love to do that.
Well, it's been good to... when you are the next Bill Hunter, please come back and talk to us again. But in the meantime, buy Mikey's book. Thank you to everybody for listening. I'm not back full-time at the moment, as you know. There's a couple of episodes that have come through. I will say this. There's been a bunch of blokes in a row, you know, that I normally try to kind of mix it up. It's just been a coincidence because I haven't been doing it full-time. But, I've got heaps of amazing... All sorts of amazing guests coming up. So when we get back into it more regularly, you know, we'll address that and get back on track. Thank you very much for listening. You can contribute to the Patreon at tofop.com if you would like. And currently I have some shows on sale. So I think that I am on sale in, definitely Melbourne International Comedy Festival for my new show, Will Informed, and Hobart at the Spiegel Tent. That one's nearly sold out, I think. I think there's Newcastle and Darwin are coming and look heaps of other places too.
I've got a slightly used mountain bike for sale as well, so just contact me.
So if you need a slightly used mountain bike, that is also available. The end.
Buy my book.